Free City Radio. This is edition 253. And on the broadcast today, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with Shane Katadil of the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is a New York-based legal organization that has really worked to advocate for the legal rights of the most marginalized, impacted by U.S. policy, both domestically and internationally. The Center for Constitutional Rights has been foundational in addressing the injustices that have faced detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And the conversation I had with Shane looks at this issue specifically. There are people in indefinite detention in Guantanamo Bay. This is a persisting issue of importance. And with the change of administration in the United States, it would be important to underline that people have been detained without release, and in some cases without having actually faced trial for many years now across different Democratic and Republican administrations. Guantanamo Bay really underlines a lot of the layers of injustice that are present in U.S. foreign policy, both domestically and internationally. And I think Shane provides an important window into what has been happening for Guantanamo Bay detainees. Sometimes this issue does spark discussion in the news cycle, but often it is under the radar. So I thought it would be important to share this conversation I recorded with Shane here on Free City Radio. So here it is.
Trying to get a handle on all the proceedings around legal maneuvering that the U.S. government's doing on cases of detainees in Guantanamo is really a challenge. But the Center for Constitutional Rights is following it closely, obviously. And, you know, it'd be really great if you could just sort of take us through what has happened recently, and most importantly, why you feel that recent events should be of concern for human rights advocates, you know, in the legal sphere or also beyond. And if you could just start by introducing yourself. Thank you.
Sure. Stefan, thanks for having me. My name is Shane Katadil, and I'm the managing attorney of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York City. And I guess people know us in part for having brought the first cases on behalf of Guantanamo detainees into the federal courts in 2002, and then winning at the Supreme Court twice as it required in 2004 and 2008. You know, after 2004, lawyers were allowed down to visit clients at the base for the first time, and so we ended up coordinating the efforts of hundreds of lawyers from all spheres of American legal life who represented individual clients. And then we also had a whole ton of cases that we ran on our own. And we still do. We're down to two clients now out of 30 who are left at the base. You know, for years, you know, our mantra in these cases had been charge or release. You know, people should either be charged and tried in a federal criminal court, or they should be released. There shouldn't be this in-between category of people who somehow we don't want to charge for some reason. You know, the implication always was that torture had contaminated the otherwise good evidence against them. They're otherwise, you know, valid or true confessions, right? That we couldn't try them because of those reasons, but we also didn't want to release them because they were bad people, right? And so the implication was everybody at Guantanamo fell into this in-between third category. Too dangerous to release, impossible for some reason to charge. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as far as legal status, for two decades, almost everybody was in that in-between category. You know, over the years, they've cleared, you know, at this point, about 740 people and sent 9 home in coffins as well. And so we've got 30 left. Out of the 30, 11 are charged at some level or convicted in the military commission system, the military's own trial system. And then the other 19, almost all of them are cleared for release, meaning they could go if they had a safe place to go tomorrow. There are 3 guys who are kind of waiting to be cleared by that system, but it's clear they're not going to be charged. And it's sort of a matter of time for them to be cleared. So that's the remainder in the kind of in-between pool that really sort of represents what Guantanamo was all about, right? So obviously, you know, there are diplomatic challenges in sending home those 19 people they're not going to charge. You know, some of them, a whole bunch of them are Yemenis. We don't want to send people to a country with a civil war where they're, you know, attacking shipping and this and that, right? Especially after October 7th. So, you know, the hope is that eventually we'll find, you know, some Gulf country or some other third country to give them asylum, to settle them there as refugees, basically. That leaves the 11 people who are charged. And there you've got really the most difficult kind of group to resolve at Guantanamo, because you've got five people who are charged with essentially being at the core of the 9/11 conspiracy, with the most culpable of the bunch being Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the kind of mastermind of the attacks, the one who came up with the idea, the one who planned it, who confessed all of this to the media, to Al Jazeera in interviews long before he was ever captured, but then was captured and tortured with waterboarding and all the rest of it in the CIA's torture system, in black site prisons all around the world, and eventually dumped back at Guantanamo for purposes of trial. So the big news was that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two more out of that group of five 9/11 defendants, that the three of them had agreed to plead guilty in the military commissions, in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table in those cases, right? A typical kind of thing that you see in very serious criminal cases. The defendant gets charged with a capital crime. In order to stay alive, they say, you know what, give me life imprisonment and I'll plead guilty. I won't put you through the trouble and risk of a trial.
A lot of points to draw on there. I think one critical point to bring up is sort of the tension and relationship between legal process and social activism, because those two things really sort of come to head around Guantanamo. Obviously, there's been intense and meaningful campaigning to have Guantanamo Bay closed. People have followed that, and I think the reasons are quite clear. On the other side of this sort of equation, there's the legal work that organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights have been doing to do, like, sort of detailed follow-up within the commission system, that by nature are very hostile to, you know, protocols around human rights, for example. I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts about why it's important to sort of see and understand those two forces at play. You know, the sort of public campaigning, but also the legal work. Because often these sort of stories or these sort of cases, let's say, are, you know, talked about in activist spheres as, you know, let's say there's a release that happens. Oh, it's driven by campaigning. But always there's many factors involved. And I think the CCR sits at a very interesting crossroads in regards to that.
Yeah. You know, if I were a journalist or an activist, you know, I might approach the current situation with, you know, plea bargains happening in the military commission system, and part of the trade-off being that these three defendants want to stay at Guantanamo, meaning they want the prison to stay open perpetually as long as they're serving their life sentences, because conditions there, ironically, are much, much better than they are in federal prisons in the United States, as you and I have discussed in our careers in the past. The supermax conditions in the U.S. have brought, you know, almost to a science the art of solitary confinement as torture. And part of the reason these defendants were willing to take the plea deal was not only taking the death penalty off the table, but you know, getting better conditions. So the goal of closing Guantanamo, physically shutting down this prison that is a symbol of all the excesses of the war on terror, you know, it'll have to be transformed if these cases get resolved by plea bargain in this fashion, because the prison physically will stay open as long as they're alive, and it'll be the system that Guantanamo represents, the system of indefinite detention without charges that we hope to shut down, right? But, you know, if I were an activist or a journalist, you know, maybe I would be, you know, expressing disdain about that aspect of this deal, or, you know, the fact that they're not being tried in federal criminal courts rather than, you know, this sort of deal which might be viewed as coercive because they're trapped in an unfair military commission system, right? I mean, we all would have preferred to see them tried in federal court. The cases would have been over a long time ago. Frankly, from the standpoint of even the family members who want to see them executed, that might have happened domestically, but it won't happen here because they'll never get to a verdict in the military commission cases, right? The system has been created from scratch. It's taken 15 years to get through what would have taken a few months in a well-established 200-year-old system like our federal criminal system. And, you know, one reason the prosecutors want this deal so bad is that the cases aren't going to get resolved. You know, they're never going to get to a death penalty. You know, it'll take 10 years to do a trial. And then there'll be a million viable appeal issues. It'll take 5 years to win those appeals for the defendants, and they'll be back at square one, right? So these are all big issues. And, you know, I could mention one other with the federal courts too, which is that the first thing that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said publicly when he had been brought to Guantanamo in his, enemy combatant status review proceeding, in the transcript that says, you know, I feel bad that women and children died on 9/11, but that's what happens in war, as you Americans well know. And then he recited Vietnam and Iraq and all the rest of our misadventures overseas, right? And, you know, I think the point to take away from that is that, you know, he wants to be seen as a warrior in a struggle against the American empire. And, you know, one would ordinarily think that the interest of our government is in having him seen as a criminal, as a terrorist, rather than some, you know, legitimate combatant who gets tried in a military proceeding. So these are all things, you know, as activists, I feel like, have been lost out on when we see these cases heading towards resolution and pleas. But, you know, it's 23 years in for Guantanamo, and we're in a situation of kind of looking for the least worst solution, right? And that's, I think, you know, it's hard for people to get around who are not lawyers, because as lawyers in an adversary system, we are stuck, you know, playing our role in the system, which is that we have to look for the best solution for our clients, right? If your client has been tortured and can't deal with solitary anymore because of what's happened to them, and wants a final resolution after, you know, 20 years of uncertainty, taking a plea deal that gives them some certainty about where they're going to be held, that keeps them with friends that they've been held with for 20 years, that avoids the death penalty, these are all real positive things. You've got to chase it wherever you can get it, even if it means the horrible symbolism of keeping the prison there open, you know, for another 3 decades or whatever it is, right? So that's, you know, I think the hard thing for people to understand maybe about some aspects of this is that, you know, those of us who've been, you know, maybe the primary advocates on these cases also have, you know, kind of a role that we consider sacred to look after the interests of our clients. And it's part of the game. That's how we got our foot into this work. You know, I mean, I feel like I'm not exaggerating when I describe it as a sacred duty. You know, we are trying to get results by whatever means we can. You know, the lawyers here, in some respects, it's an astonishing job, right, to have pulled it off for what amounted to 3 days to have a plea deal signed. So
there's all these systems at play here. And, you know, Guantanamo is an interesting example because I think it sort of challenges this idea of the sanctity of process, like legal process, and sort of like this idea that there's a through line you can follow around like the institutions of the state vis-a-vis the law or the United States in this example. And I think it's interesting in the sense that it opens this box to think about all these intersecting systems and also illustrates, you know, this idea that a lot of law, in a sense, is improvised, right? And in the moment, in the historical moment. I'm wondering if you could maybe share any thoughts about that. And you mentioned very specifically the CIA torture system. And I'm just underlining here the word system because there's an implication there of sort of a process on its own, in its own context, too, that also intersects with these other processes.
Yeah, boy, there's a whole lot tied up in there. I mean, you know, hearing you say that, I mean, you know, the first thing that jumps to mind is that people who practice every day in our federal criminal systems, whether in Canada or in the U.S., probably are doing a double take at hearing about least worst solution because maybe they view their whole role in the domestic trial system as being finding, you know, least worst solutions in a system is really stacked up against defendants, right? I mean, it's funny, in America, if you talk to lay people about the criminal justice system, their impressions of it may be formed by the O.J. Simpson trial, right? And a bunch of crime dramas from the 70s reacting to the Warren Court's decisions here that created all sorts of process protections and, you know, the exclusionary rule where, you know, physical evidence gets thrown out sometimes because a police officer has messed up in seizing it, right? Americans view that combination of things, the Warren Court's process innovations and the O.J. trial, is meaning the technicalities are the reason that more people don't get convicted, right? When people who actually practice in these systems day in and day out know that they're just as bad as the military commission systems, that 92% of people plead and, you know, a similar number get convicted, that, you know, it's not like you get your day in court in front of a jury of your peers all the time. It's distressing. You know, on the other hand, I mean, you know, there's always been a narrative around these cases, and it's been sold to the 9/11 victim families, you know, the 10,000 or so people, one degree of separation out from people who died in the Trade Center and Pentagon, that these cases have, that there is a technicality here that, you know, is behind kind of these sort of plea deals, right? And it's the reason that a lot of the family members came out against the plea bargains in the first couple of days after it was announced, which is that they think the reason these guys can't be tried is torture evidence, right? Torture is a reason that prosecutors have been gun-shy about going forward all the way with trials. It's probably behind the thinking of prosecutors wanting this deal to happen, but not in that way, right? So, sure, you know, the military would love to use their outright confessions to all sorts of things that were, you know, taken during the CIA's torture, you know, which was a systematic attempt to get people to confess, right, as it always is. But there was lots of evidence that wasn't contaminated by torture, right? You know, again, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and kind of the number two person who's not being tried, not pleading out because they're suffering from schizophrenia, a guy named Ramzi Binalshib, they gave an extensive interview to Yossi Fouda with Al Jazeera in the spring of 2002, talking about the, you know, the logistics and why they did it in Karachi, I think it was. They blindfolded the journalist and swapped him between a bunch of cars, and it's all on tape. All that stuff is admissible, right? There are supposedly, you know, tapes of these guys talking in the prison yards, which generally would be admissible, right? It's just like, you know, the way the cops put a snitch in the cell next to you in jail and get you to start chit-chatting, right? Classic sort of stuff. Every prosecutor knows that that stuff usually is admissible. And then there are cooperators. You know, we represented a guy who pled guilty and agreed to turn sort of state's evidence. So again, you know, it's not this sort of weird technicality kind of, you know, 70s crime drama thing that's happening here. The real problem is that, you know, Congress in the U.S. made such a stink when Obama was president about physically bringing these guys into the U.S. for trial, that now they're kind of physically stuck being tried offshore in the Guantanamo system, if that makes any sense. You know, there is this sort of perception among a lot of the family members, not all, but a lot, that somehow this system is tougher, even though we're into year 15 of these charges, and it really hasn't gotten off the starting blocks. A lot of weird, kind of ironic, somewhat counterfactual pressures here behind this. I will mention one other thing about torture, though. You know, I think the delays and the slowness of this system because of its novelty are one of the reasons prosecutors maybe think they'll never get to a death penalty, just because time will pass and these guys are in their mid-50s, two of them, and, you know, they'll probably pass away before we ever get a legitimate verdict. But another reason is that, you know, occasionally we've seen juries, whether they're federal civilian juries or military commission juries of military officers, show clemency, show sympathy to defendants because of the torture that happened to them, right? So Obama did manage to bring one guy from Guantanamo to be tried for the East Africa embassy bombings in 1998. This guy was tried in 2009, 2010. And there was a conspiracy charge for carrying out the bombings and then 200 individual murder charges. The jury convicted on the conspiracy charge and acquitted on all the subsidiary murder charges, which was not something that was logically consistent. And so it's clear that they did it in order to kind of send a message to the government that we're really upset about what we heard about happened to this guy after he was captured. And so all the prosecutors, civilian and military, I think, are fearful that a jury being a black box and empowered to do whatever it feels is just behind the walls of the deliberation room, you know, may do something like this in even something as high stakes as a 9/11 case.
Can you locate us a bit, just for people who are hearing this conversation and catching it on a community station, radio station in Canada? Can you just locate a bit your work? Because you're sharing, you know, I think very important insights. But Center for Constitutional Rights, what is it? And just sort of ground us in a bit of where you're coming from.
Well, sure. Yeah. So CCR, you know, is you know, a legal nonprofit, a small nonprofit law firm supported by donations and foundations and so forth, just like the ACLU or the NAACP in the United States. You know, the NAACP brought all these desegregation cases. The ACLU created all of, like, modern First Amendment law and all sorts of other stuff, right? But those two organizations, much larger, much longer history. And in the 60s, a kind of liberal heyday for the American Supreme Court, their model was advance the law one little step at a time by finding the perfect squeaky clean plaintiff and the perfect sensible sort of issue and winning and advancing the ball, you know, a yard down the field, to use the American football analogy, right? CCR's model was kind of the converse of that. You know, CCR was all about the protesters in the street trying to stop the war, the freedom riders going down south and doing civil disobedience. And our model was that, you know, the courts historically are reactionary institutions and are there to preserve the status quo and existing power scheme. And what we really want to do with litigation is use it as a way to lever up political activism, because political activism and movements in the street are what actually accomplish lasting, durable political change. So with the Freedom Riders, you know, we weren't suing to desegregate schools. We were suing to stop Southern sheriffs from getting in the way of activists going down from the north and intimidating them with legal process, right? You know, and to some extent, you know, this was kind of guerrilla warfare in the courts. You know, winning isn't important if you're trying to advance the ball. Sometimes losing and making a big stink out of it in the media and using it to organize and agitate more people to join, to get more people from the north to come down, because look what they're doing to your fellow students, you know, who were down here just doing sit-ins. That kind of thing can be more effective than winning in court. You know, so that's kind of the organizational philosophy. Does it apply exactly to, you know, work like Guantanamo, where we really needed to win that first Supreme Court case in order to get lawyers in to actually meet with clients and hear all the terrible things that happened to them, and then use that information to do political activism outside to get their European countries and their Arab countries to agitate because they were so infuriated at what had happened to their citizens, that their governments demanded the U.S. send them home, right? You know, it doesn't exactly fit the model because victory was really, really important. But in some senses, it does, because, you know, until we won, you know, that case it had been, you know, an unalloyed record of defeat in the lower courts. And yet we had brought a lot of attention to the place and to what was happening there. You know, the first people who told their stories of torture were all released en masse between the Supreme Court agreeing to hear the case in December 03 and actually sitting down for the oral argument in April 2004. The military released people to kind of show the court, hey, we're going to sort this out. We're not holding them forever. And these are the people who told all these crazy sounding stories about, you know, they had prostitutes come through and smear us with menstrual blood and all the other torture things that didn't even seem real to me until 2 weeks after the argument, when the Abu Ghraib photographs were published. And I think, you know, that kind of confluence of great work by journalists and organizing and activism and legal effort, you know, really all came together, which is, you know, the reason 740 guys are home. But you know, getting the last 30 out is going to require, you know, a lot of creativity. And I suppose these plea bargains were part of that.
Last point for this conversation, and thank you so much for sharing that. Back to the physical location of Guantanamo Bay and the creation of worlds and legal infrastructure. I'm thinking of Lauren Benton's book, Search for Sovereignty, and sort of like this idea of like the ways that legal infrastructure is created through political process. One example in that book is a trial that was established in early colonial outpost here in Quebec, indigenous territory, where there were Champlain tried members of a colonial expedition for saying that they wanted to create an autonomous colonial settlement outside of the framework of the French monarchy. And they were tried and executed. But that was one of the first legal cases from the French monarchy, basically, that established sovereignty, quote unquote, in what is now, quote unquote, Quebec. And I'm thinking about just like how trippy and violent and problematic. There's so many different words you could use to describe Guantanamo as a physical place. But any sort of last thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, Americans like to think America is a big country that didn't have any colonies, and we won World War II, and we, you know, part of that was freeing, you know, the whole developing world, right, from European colonialism, right? But point of fact, you know, we, you know, defeated the Spanish in 1898 in the Spanish-American War and stole all their remaining colonies, right? Puerto Rico being maybe the most notable, you know, kind of them, but Guantanamo is a remnant of that, right? The, you know, we created a Cuban Republic from Spain's colony in Cuba. Took over the Deepwater Harbor at Guantanamo under a perpetual lease that both sides have to agree to end it. So it's, you know, not like Hong Kong's 99-year lease for the British. It's a, you know, we stay there as long as we want. But technically, because it's Cuba, that was the government's argument, the Bush administration's argument, for why federal courts didn't have any say in what happens to non-citizens who happen to be held there, right? It's a place where the military, U.S. military, can operate completely autonomously. This was their argument, without any intervention from the federal courts, even though everything was being controlled from Washington, you know, right down to the details of torture plans. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, one of our last remaining colonies. And it's pretty easy to remember this when you go around the gift shop there. And they'll have T-shirts where there's a map of Cuba with a giant chain around it and a big, you know, American flag planted where Guantanamo is, you know, and the label is like freedom or something like that.
So. Thanks so much for sharing your reflections today and for the conversation.
Thanks, Stefan. Great to see you as always.
That was a conversation with Shane Katadil of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, talking about the legal cases and struggles of Guantanamo Bay detainees today, particularly important as we witness this shift and change in U.S. administrations and the fact that people have been detained across administrations in the United States under Democratic and Republican governments. Thank you so much to Shane for being on the program this week. This series is supported by the Social Justice Center at Concordia University. I'm Stefan Christoph. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CGLO 1690 a.m., also in Geauguette, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC, on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays. And now on CKCU, 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. You can find us as a podcast. Just search your favorite podcast platforms. And we will be with you next week. And you can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks for listening, and I will speak to you next week.